عشان ترابها بجد ضحهم نفسهم شهداء لو من عليهم ربنا اللي في صفهم شهداء علشان يعلوا في مصر يوقفوا يهتفوا شهداء وما همهمش يموتوا بيها وينزفوا شهداء. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining me now is Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Her essay, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books, and she lives in Cairo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
And it seems to me that, well, let me ask you, do you think these changes announced today are a positive step forward? Not just the idea that they're going to sack over 700 police officers, including 505 major generals, 82 colonels, 82 brigadiers, and arresting 13 of these officers on charges of killing the protesters. But the military have said that they would draft guidelines for selecting the 100-member assembly that will write a new Egyptian constitution. And some analysts say that this could make it more difficult for any Islamist-led legislature to choose the body and therefore give the charter an Islamist slant. What's your reading on that?
Well, I think that, take the first part of your question, that the changes announced, you know, I think that they're a step forward, but I don't think they're going to appease the protesters who are still in Tahrir Square. I was speaking to people today, and they're still not happy. They want the prime minister himself to go. They want the cabinet to change. So I think that even though it's a step in the right direction, I think that it's still considered somewhat cosmetic. About the Islamists, I mean, if we look back to the first a yes-no referendum vote we had after Mubarak stepped down, the group that was chosen to draft the proposed constitutional amendments, they included Muslim Brotherhood members. They included Islamists. And I think that in any sort of body that is chosen to draft something, there will be most definitely both Islamist representation and representation of conservatives, because they do make up a significant portion right now of the political voice and discourse that we're seeing. I also think that on the one hand, anything could happen between now and the elections, you know, slow down the process of sort of Islamists coming into a more powerful position within the government. However, I feel that they do represent a significant portion of the population. Egyptians are conservative. Islam is a core part of their daily lives, and, you know, we can't overlook that.
Well, it seems that what's happened so far is that the people who actually initiated the revolution and made most of the sacrifices are the ones that are getting shafted, to use a rather crude word, as opposed to the Muslim Brotherhoods, who in many ways sat on the sidelines. The ruling military council appears to be biased towards them. And in your article, Yasmin El-Rashidi, in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, you point out in a conversation with an Egyptian general that he says, with the Brotherhood, the military know what they're getting. With the revolutionaries and liberals, they don't.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this force that peered out of nowhere, which was the momentum of the revolution, these people taking to the streets, I think that, you know, it surprised everyone. It surprised even the protesters themselves who went down on January 25th and 26th and 27th. Nobody expected it would be so large. And I think the military council is extremely weary. They're anxious about this force. When might it erupt again? You know, when might it rise again and threaten them next? I mean, about the Muslim Brotherhood having been on the sidelines, I have to disagree there in that although on January 25th, when one looked at the people in the square, for the most part they were young. A large portion of them were sort of upper middle class activist students, artists, professionals who are active on Twitter and Facebook. on the 28th, which was, I think, the turning point for what became the revolution, the demographic had changed significantly, and there was a much larger portion of the middle class, and the Muslim Brotherhood members were beginning to come out. By the 29th, when a critical mass had been reached, I believe it was because the Muslim Brotherhood and their followers had come out.
Was that because politically they realized that they were missing the boat? I mean, what explains their earlier caution?
Their earlier caution, I think, is based on sort of they were really oppressed under the former regime. They were rounded up and thrown in jail by the hundreds. And there have been many calls for protest before. Usually a few hundred people would show up. They would be cordoned off by police. After a few hours, some of them would be rounded up and thrown in jail. The others would eventually leave. And so no one really believed that the January 25th call would emerge as it did. Nobody really expected it to gather that many people or sustain itself in the way that it did. On the 28th, something changed. I mean, you could see that Egypt was on the brink of change. The riot police fled the streets, literally, because the youth protesters were so determined to move forward and take over the square. They battled through the tear gas, they battled through the rubber bullets, and the riot police were defeated. And that's when the army came down in the street. At that point, I think it was clear that the people's movement had a very different kind of momentum, a very different strength. And this was something that, yes, it was serious. I think they felt that the regime could not round them up and throw them in jail. It would be doing that to tens of thousands of Egyptians if it took that move.
Again, I'm speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the new book, The Battle for Egypt. Her article, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books. And I'm trying to get a sense of, obviously, history tells us in the case of the Russian Revolution and the more recent Iranian Revolution that there's an initial revolution that looks hopeful, and then the hardliners emerge out of the woodwork and steal the revolution. So I think that's the subtext, is it not, of the fear about the Islamists?
It is. I mean, it is. And you know, if one asks, is Egypt moving in the right direction or the wrong direction? Most people, it's sort of become inherent to the wrong direction. It's, you know, the question of the Islamists. Whereas I think that if one steps back and looks objectively, you know, the Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood, have worked very, very hard to reach out to the people of Egypt over the years, where the government has failed in offering subsidized goods and social services, the Muslim Brotherhood has stepped in. And that's how they gained their support. That's how they gained a lot of their followers. Not to mention, of course, their slogan, Islam is the answer. And, you know, as Muslims, they always say, leave it to Allah. You know, it's in God's hands. So they've won supporters by very strategically, you know, working at a grassroots level, offering what any government should. So could we call this stealing the revolution? You know, in a way, they've been working very hard too, but perhaps in a more, you know, proactive, organized manner. And I think that where the youth protesters have failed is that post Mubarak stepping down, they have not organized themselves and mobilized and come together to reach out to the people in the way that the Islamists are.
Well, I suppose this gets to the heart, and I take it that that's why the liberals or the revolutionaries or whatever the correct term for this inchoate group is, they wanted to postpone the elections, which is apparently happening, in order to get more organized. But I don't see necessarily a political platform there. But surely there is a broader issue here, isn't there, that Egypt is the heart of Arab culture, and it has largely developed along a secular and modern lines. And there is this notion, particularly when you have the Salafist elements, that there is a constituency, I'm not sure how big it is, in Egypt, fueled and by Saudi money, I believe, that wants to emulate the Saudi situation and create a kind of theocracy. So could you qualify that for us?
I think, you know, that there's a lot of talk now. I feel that the situation in Egypt has been painted in this portrait of black and white. you know, black being Egypt's about to become like Iran or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And I think two things are important to keep in mind is one, that anyone who's been to Egypt understands Egyptians really like to have a good time. You know, they go out at night, there is alcohol, even though, you know, a lot of them don't drink. They enjoy music. Women like to dress up, but they put on makeup, even if they're veiled. And women work and drive. You know, life is not like it is in the West, but it is pretty open compared to other countries in the Arab world. I think Egyptians would be reluctant to let go of a lot of those freedoms. They are religious, but I don't think they would easily accept a state modeled on Saudi Arabia or Iran. And the Islamists, I think they understand that. And I don't think, you know, yes, I personally do, from what I see, I believe that we will move towards a more conservative state. We will move towards a state where Islamist thinkers have a much greater say in the political landscape of the country. However, I think that any changes they bring forward will be implemented very, very slowly, because they understand that to win the people over, they can't sort of suddenly overnight say women have to cover up, they can't drive, they have to stay at home. They understand that they can't do that.
Well, I don't mean to sound like a stupid Westerner by beating a dead horse here, Yasmin El-Rashidi. I did speak fairly recently with the Egyptian novelist Al-Aswani, and it was he who brought up the Saudi specter, the Saudi money, the Salafists, and portrayed in terms of the counter-revolutions, if you will, to the Arab Spring as the Saudi regime. And he was quite outspoken about it. And indeed, it is true that during Tahrir Square, every day, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia would call up President Obama and scream at him and say, you've got to let Mubarak kill those kids in Tahrir Square.
Well, I mean, yes, one can't deny the Saudi. I'm so glad that Hosni Mubarak didn't listen to him, because I would not be speaking to you now. But, you know, yes, when you speak to, I'm not an expert on Salafism. But I have spoken to experts, and I've spoken to Salafi, you know, leaders and sheikhs. There is Saudi financing of Salafi elements in Egypt. I don't believe it's state-funded, though. I believe it is single wealthy individuals who are channeling money to Egypt to support certain movements like that. And, you know, everyone knows, and there's evidence, documented evidence of it, that, you know, Saudi king offered billions of dollars to the military so that they do not move forward with the trial of Mubarak. So absolutely, Saudi Arabia has interests, and I think it's, you know, manipulating a situation in Egypt. But I don't think that alone is enough to sort of create the space for Egypt to overnight turn into an Iran or a Saudi Arabia. I have my concerns about the direction we're moving in, but I don't think it's going to happen in the short term. I don't even think it's going to happen in the medium term. And I think that when you look at, if you speak to the Muslim Brotherhood, the leading Muslim Brotherhood members and thinkers, when you look at their actions and their strategy, they're extremely savvy. They're savvier than sort of all of us liberals put together. And they will work very carefully both to make sure that the military remains, you know, complicit with them, and the military would not be in favor of, you know, an Egypt modeled on Saudi Arabia or Iran. And they will also work very hard to make sure that the liberals and the youth don't turn entirely against them, because they have sort of caused some, you know, waves of discontent since Mubarak stepped down, which is why they chose, after distancing themselves from the revolutionary movement, on July 8th, they chose to go back down in Tahrir Square in solidarity with the youth Muslim Brothers who have had disagreements with them, and with the liberals.
So, Yasmin El-Rashidi, I recently hosted a forum at the UCLA Hammer Forum here in Los Angeles with Rabab El Mahdi and Jawad Nabulsi, a young entrepreneur who was shot in the eye on the first night of the revolution, still has buckshot in his eye, as a matter of fact. And Rabab, you know, she was also a founding member, along with Ala Raswani, of Kafaya, the earlier movement. Both of these Egyptian activists made it very, very clear that they believe that the Arab Spring is inevitable, that all of these regimes, including the Saudi regimes, will eventually fall. Probably Syria soon, Yemen is teetering, et cetera, and even Saudi Arabia. So if they are right, much of what we're talking about would go away, because my understanding is if there is a youth revolution in Saudi Arabia, it would probably be rather anti-secular from the frustrated youth who can't stand the oppression of the Wahhabi theocracy.
I mean, absolutely. When you look at, you know, the Arab, the populations of the Arab world, 60% of the population of the Arab world are youth, I believe, under the age of 25. But I think, you know, I think what you know, the hinge of that is the hinge of which way things go, I think, boils down to economics. When you look at why, to take Egypt, why do people join the Muslim Brotherhood? You know, yes, I think that obviously, you know, we lean towards Islam in Egypt. It's the religion. People do have very strong faith. But what is the final thing that wins them over? It's sort of the economic promise. It's the subsidized goods. It's the social services. It's the support that these people are giving Egyptians in their day-to-day lives to enable them to put food on their tables. And I think Saudi Arabia, even though it's an extremely wealthy country, my father lived there for many years, and I've reported on it extensively, there is widespread poverty. And I think, again, there, you know, the youth are frustrated by the lack of freedom, but they are also frustrated by the lack of opportunity. And I think that ultimately it depends where the money is coming from.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Yasmin El-Rashidi, and your article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists. It seems in many ways that you're not talking about a monolithic movement. You're talking about a rather, and I understand that the Brotherhood is split into various factions, some conservative and some more modernist. So just in closing, qualify the Victorious Islamists, because you have not painted a picture of an inevitable Islamic victory in terms of who's going to be running Egypt.
You know, I think the victory comes in terms of actually where are we now, who has the influence, who has the organizational structure, who has the resources. And I think that that ultimately is what will, you know, color or dictate who has the greatest influence in the country, even if they're not in the position of the president or the prime minister or the ministers. I think that if both on a grassroots level and on a level, managerial level, in terms of the government, there is a significant presence of Islamist or conservative thought, I would say that they are victorious. And from what we know, they are already, you know, in that position. If not, you know, in some cases, I think they're on their way to taking higher positions of office within the government. But they definitely have greater influence, a much more organized structure, a greater just movement of support than I think anyone else, any individual group right now in the country. So I think in many people's minds, they are already victorious.
Well, I thank you for joining us again, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the new book, The Battle for Egypt. Her article, Egypt, the Victorious Islamists, is in the July 14th issue of the New York Review of Books. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.
Answer.